Chapter 9. Austin strapped the last waterproof stuff bag onto the Seamobile's flat rear deck behind the bubble cockpit and stepped back to inspect the job. The vehicle looked more like a mechanical pack mule than a high-tech submersible, but the jury-rigged arrangement would have to do. With no idea how many people were trapped under the glacier, he had rounded up every set of scuba equipment and backup gear he could find and simply hoped for the best. Austin gave an okay sign to Francois. The government observer had been standing by with a hand radio, acting as a combined liaison and translator between the ship and the helicopter. Francois returned the gesture and spoke into a hand radio. The pilot of the French helicopter was waiting for the call. Within minutes, the helicopter was lifting off the beach. It flew out to the Numa boat, where it hovered and dropped a cable down to the deck. Austin ducked his head against the blast from the spinning rotors, grabbed the hook at the end of the cable, and attached it to a four-point harness system. He and the crew had already secured the trailer and submersible so the load could be lifted in one piece. He gave the pilot a thumbs up. The cable went taut and the helicopter rose slightly and hung in space with its rotors madly slashing the air. Despite the ear-shattering racket, the submersible and trailer only lifted a few inches off the deck. The combined weight of the sub, trailer, and cargo were beyond the aircraft's lifting capacity. Austin signaled the chopper to ease off. The line went slack and the load thumped back onto the deck. Austin pointed to the helicopter and shouted in Francois's ear, "Tell them to stay where they are until I figure this out." As Francois translated, Austin got on his own radio and called Zavala, who had been circling high above the ship. "We've got a problem," Austin said. "So I see." "Wish this chopper was a sky crane," he said, referring to the huge industrial helicopters that were designed to hoist big loads. "We may not need one." Austin laid out what he had in mind. Zavala laughed and said, "My life must have been very dull before I met you." "Well?" "Tricky," Zavala said. "Dangerous as hell. Audacious, but possible." Austin never doubted his partner's flying skills. Zavala had thousands of hours as a pilot in helicopters, small jet, and turboprop aircraft. It was the vagaries, the unexpected, that bothered him. A shift of the wind, human inattention, or equipment failure could turn a carefully calculated risk into a disaster. In this case, the job could end with a mix-up in translation. He had to be sure the message was clear. He pulled Francois aside and told him what he wanted the French pilot to do. Then he made him repeat his instructions back to him. Francois nodded in understanding. He spoke into his radio, and the French helicopter moved off to the side so that the lifting line was at an angle. Zavala's chopper darted in and dropped a line, which Austin quickly spliced onto the harness. He gave the choppers a visual check, making sure there was plenty of space between the two aircraft. They would be pulled together by the weight they were lifting, and he didn't want the helicopter's tangling rotors. Once more, Austin gave the signal to lift. The rotors churned away in ear-splitting concert, and this time the submersible and trailer seemed to leap skyward. A foot, 2 feet, a yard, 2 yards. The pilots were well aware of the fact that the helicopters were of unequal size and power, and adjusted for the difference with amazing skill. They rose in slow motion, the strange load swinging between them until they were a couple of hundred feet above the lake surface, and then they flew toward land until they were lost against the dark rock of the mountains. Zavala kept up a running commentary over the radio. He had to break off a couple of times to correct his position. Austin didn't breathe easily until he heard Zavala's laconic announcement, "The Eagles have landed." Austin and several crewmen scrambled into a small boat and were on shore waiting when the helicopters came back, flying side by side, and landed on the beach. Austin climbed into Zavala's chopper, and the French helicopter took on crew from the Mummichug. Minutes later, they dropped down for a landing near the bright yellow Seamobile, which was on its trailer in front of the tunnel entrance. Austin supervised the crew as they adjusted the sub's load. Then the trailer was backed into the sloping tunnel to the water's edge. Chocks were inserted behind the wheels, while Austin left the tunnel to confer with Lessard. At Austin's request, the plant supervisor had retrieved another blueprint from his trove. He spread it out on a flat rock. These are the internal aluminum supports I told you about. You'll encounter them a few hundred feet inside the tunnel. There are 12 sets laid three abreast, approximately 10 yards between one set and the other. The submersible is less than 8 feet wide, Austin said. I figured out that I'll only have to cut one column in each set to squeeze through. I suggest that you stagger your cuts. In other words, don't cut the same column position in every set. As you can see by this diagram, the ceiling is the thinnest here of any place within the tunnel. You've got hundreds of tons of ice and rock pressing down on the tunnel. I've figured that into the equation. Lessard's eyes bored into Austin's face. I called Paris after you posed your plan and talked to a friend in the state power company. He said this end of the tunnel was built to move the lab trailers into place. It was discarded as prime access because as time went on, there was danger of the roof collapsing. The columns were installed to keep the tunnel open as a ventilating air shaft. This is what worries me, he said, drawing his finger across the top of the tunnel drawn on the blueprint. There's a large, unstable pocket of water here. Because of the lateness of the season, it is even bigger than usual. If there is a weakness in the support system, the whole ceiling could come down. It's worth the risk, Austin said. You've considered the possibility that you're risking your lives in vain, that the people are already dead. Austin replied with a grim smile. We won't know that until we take a look, will we? Lessard regarded Austin with an expression of admiration. The American with the pale hair and arresting blue eyes was either insane or supremely confident in his abilities. You must like this woman very much. I only met her a few days ago, but we have a dinner date in Paris and I intend to keep it. Lessard replied with a shrug. Gallantry was something a Frenchman could appreciate. The first few weeks are the time of maximum attraction between a man and a woman, before they know each other well. Well, bonne chance, mon ami. I see your friend wants your attention. Austin thanked Lessard for his advice and went over to where Zavala was standing in front of the tunnel entrance. I've gone over the sub's control system. Pretty simple stuff, Zavala said. I knew you wouldn't have a problem. Austin took a last glance around. Time to vamonos, amigo. Zavala gave him a sour look. You've been watching too many reruns of the Cisco Kid. Austin pulled on an insulated one-piece dry suit. Looking like a big day-glow Gumby, he led the way into the tunnel and slipped a helmet containing an underwater acoustic transceiver onto his head. Zavala helped him on with his air tank and weight belt, and then gave him a hand climbing onto the back of the submersible. He sat behind the bubble using the waterproof stuff bags as a seat and pulled on his fins. A crewman handed up a lightweight underwater cutting torch and oxygen tank, which Austin secured to the deck with bungee cords. Zavala got into the cabin and gave Austin the high sign. Ready to roll? Austin said, testing his headset. Sure, but I feel like the Bubble Boy. You can trade places with me anytime you'd like, Bubble Boy. Zavala chuckled. Thanks, but I'll pass on the generous offer. You look natural riding shotgun, Tex. Austin rapped on the bubble. He was ready. The launch crew lifted the trailer hitch and slowly let the trailer roll into the water, keeping its speed under control with a pair of launching lines until the wheels were submerged. As soon as the vehicle started to float, the crew jerked on the pull lines and pushed the vehicle at the same time. The Seamobile vehicle floated free of the trailer and the motors came alive. Zavala used the lateral thrusters on the tail section to put the Seamobile into a 360-degree turn facing the vehicle into the tunnel. He moved the vehicle forward until the water was deep enough to submerge. Using a light touch on the vertical thruster, he pushed the sub down until the hull was underwater. The tail thrusters whirred again, the submersible moved forward, going deeper, and the water washed over Austin and the bubble. The quartet of halogen lights in the front of the vehicle played off the orange walls and ceiling, and the reflected light gave the water a brownish cast. Zavala's metallic voice came over Austin's earphones. This is like diving into a bucket of chocolate mole sauce. I'll remember that the next time I eat in a Mexican restaurant. I was thinking about something more poetic and Dante-ish, like a descent into Hades. At least Hades is warm and dry. How far are the first support columns? Austin stared into the murk beyond the reach of the lights and thought he saw a dull glint of metal. He stood up and leaned against the bubble, holding on to the D-shaped protective bars that flanked the cabin. I think they're coming up now. Zavala slowed the submersible to a stop a few yards from the first set of aluminum columns, each about 6 inches across, that barred the way. Carrying the torch and tank, Austin swam to the base of the middle column. He ignited the torch, and the sharp blue flame quickly cut through the metal close to the base. At the top of the column, he made another cut, and then he yelled, "Timber!" and pushed the middle section out. He motioned for Zavala to follow, directing him through the gap with hand signals, like an airport worker guiding a plane to its gate. Then he went on to the next set of columns. As he swam, he cast a wary glance above his head and tried not to think of the thousands of gallons of water and tons of ice pressing down on the thin rock ceiling. Heeding Lesara's advice, he cut the right-hand column on the second set. Again, Zavala moved the vehicle through. Austin cut a middle column, then a left-hand one on the next set. Then he started the process over again. The work went smoothly. Before long, 12 columns lay on the tunnel floor. Austin resumed his seat on the back of the submersible and told Zavala to go at the vehicle's top speed of 2.5 knots. Although they were moving at a brisk walk, the darkness and the closeness of the walls combined to make it seem to Austin as if he were on Neptune's chariot flying down to the abyss. With nothing to do but hold on, he extended his thoughts to the difficult task ahead. Lesar's words echoed in his ears. The Frenchman was right about maximum attraction. He might also be right about everyone in the tunnel being dead. It had been easier being optimistic while he was in daylight. But as they plunged deeper into the Stygian darkness, he knew that the rescue attempt could be in vain. He had to admit that there was little chance that anyone could remain alive for long in this dreadful place. Reluctantly, he steeled himself for the worst.